Tonight, Sri Aurobindo speaks to us about life. Chapter 19 in the Life Divine. And it opens with a citation from the Taittiriya Upanishad. Pranic energy, prana, is the life, ayus, of creatures. For that is said to be the universal principle of life, sarvayusha. We perceive, then, what mind is in its divine origin and how it is related to the truth consciousness. Mind, the highest of the three lower principles which constitute our human existence. It is a special action of the divine consciousness, or rather, it is the final strand of its whole creative action. It enables the Purusha to hold apart the relations of different forms and forces of himself to each other. It creates phenomenal differences, which, to the individual soul fallen from the truth consciousness, take the appearance of radical divisions. And it is by that original perversion, the parent of all the resultant perversions, which impress us as the contrary dualities and oppositions proper to the life of the soul in the ignorance. But so long as it is not separated from the supermind, it supports not perversions and falsehoods, but the various working of the universal truth. So he's telling us here that the mind is an extending functionary of the creative truth consciousness. He will come to tell us that it is a creative and perceptive power delegated by the supramental. We have here a number of things worth looking at. For instance, we grasp that the mind could be an extending action of the supramental, but he says that this aspect of the mind enables the Purusha to hold apart the relations of different forms. Do you remember, just a couple of pages back, he had almost the identical language to describe the nature of the supramental working through the mind to establish the multiplicity. Here's a quotation from just the last chapter. Mind fulfills luminously its function, which is, in the truth, to hold forms apart from each other by a phenomenal, a purely formal delimitation of their activity, behind which the governing universality of the being remains conscious and untouched. So mind does this. It holds things apart. Now, as he says, this should, in truth, mean that there are differences in formation, but here, looking back from the multiplicity upwards, they appear to us to be radical divisions, and that's the error. Also worth noting here that his use of the term Purusha, which goes back to earlier chapters, calls to us a larger frame of reference. The Purusha as the supreme in distributing itself into manifold expression actively identifies itself with each of the multiplications of himself and then looks back from that at the whole. So again, that recalls to us that image, that striking metaphor or idea that's in the Gita, that this stands in the heart of all beings, this supreme person, and continues to support from the multiplicity. So, if that supreme standing in that soul as it is held apart from the whole and concentrates, focuses upon itself, ignoring all the rest, thus takes that step which allows differentiation to become division. I see myself here and I look back at the whole and I wonder what it is. But just moments before, that same soul, and that great harmonic consciousness of the supermind, was aware of itself as part of the all, as the one stationed in me, as in that, isn't lost at all. But now, concentrating itself in this stance, where the mind takes this action to, yes, I will hold these forms apart, that's what you asked me to do, and I shall do it. Well, as it becomes the central field of play to itself, this division eventuates. So there is a failure of vision when we concentrate only upon ourselves, and isn't this true in our active lives? Then when we do that, we lose the meaning of the whole, and we lose that from which the whole and ourselves came. So, in the field governed by the supermind, the mind does not stray, does not wander, and is not lost. It functions within the truth. It's only when it steps outside the rays of that supermental light that this could occur. And so, given that that's its function, he continues, mind thus appears as a creative cosmic agency. Ah, it has a role in the creation. Even though in the last chapter he said that mind cannot be the creator of the universe, it has a role. Let's see what he means. This is not the impression which we normally have of our mentality. Rather, we regard it primarily as a perceptive organ, perceptive of things already created by force working in matter, and the only origination we allow to it is a secondary creation of new combined forms from those already developed by force in matter. In other words, with mind, we can construct from the materials given to us. But the knowledge we are now recovering, aided by the last discoveries of science, begins to show us that in this force and in this matter, there is a subconscious mind at work which is certainly responsible for its own emergence. First, in the forms of life, and secondly, in the forms of mind itself. First, in the nervous consciousness of plant life and the primitive animal. Secondly, in the ever-developing mentality of the evolved animal and of man. And, as we have already discovered, that matter is only substance form of force, a la physics, so we shall discover that material force is only energy form of mind. Material force is, in fact, a subconscious operation of will. Will that works in us in what seems to be light, though it is in truth no more than a half-light, and material force that works in what seems to be a darkness of unintelligence, are yet really and in essence the same, as materialistic thought has always instinctively felt from the wrong or lower end of things, and as spiritual knowledge working from the summit had long ago discovered. We may say, therefore, that it is a subconscious mind or intelligence which, manifesting force as its driving power, its executive nature, its prakriti, has created this material world. So, from the above to the below, from concept to action, force and will, connoting the conscious force of Satchitananda, Chit Tapas, matter, a subconsciously constructive reality that meets our experience, actually arises from mind subconscious in matter. So mind is embedded in matter and secretly, in a sense, steers its operations. So matter cannot be completely inconscient. Consciousness is involved in it, so it is subconscious, but intelligence, awareness, is there, submerged, even in the workings of the material universe. But since, he writes, as we have now found, mind is no independent and original entity, but only a final operation of the truth consciousness or supermind. Therefore, wherever mind is, there supermind must be. They cannot be apart. We're looking for the supramental, trying to grasp it, to pull it down from above. Secretly, it's already present in us. Not only present in us, but present universally. Because the universe is a representation of mind, which means supermind is implied. Supermind, or the truth consciousness, is the real creative agency of the universal existence. Even when mind is in its own darkened consciousness, separated from its source, yet is that larger movement always there in the workings of mind, forcing them to preserve their right relation, evolving from them the inevitable results they bear in themselves, producing the right tree from the right seed. It compels even the operations of so brute, inert, and darkened a thing as material force to result in a world of law, of order, of right relation, and not, as it would otherwise be, of hurtling chance and chaos. This implies the presence of what he has called the right idea, the real idea, which is another descriptor to the supermind, drawn from Vedic imagery. So what compels an order to come into being from material energy is this secret awareness, this consciousness, which might be obscured, but is nonetheless present. Obviously, he writes, this order and right relation can only be relative and not the supreme order and supreme right, which would reign if mind were not in its own consciousness separated from supermind. It is an arrangement, an order of the results right and proper to the action of dividing mind and its creation of separative oppositions, its dual contrary sides of the one truth. So in other words, because mind is apparently dominant, so come the domination of the divisions. The domination of the ignorance, having ignored the omnipresence of that supreme self. The divine consciousness, having conceived and thrown into operation the idea of this dual or divided representation of itself, deduces from it in real idea, and educes practically from it in substance of life by the governing action of the whole truth consciousness behind it, its own inferior truth or inevitable result of various relation. So since Sri Aurobindo has given us an example of his splendid wordsmithing here, let's see how he combines these. This divided representation of itself, deducing from it, real idea, and then educing from it, substance of life. To deduce means literally to lead from, deducere, to lead from, to derive or work out logically, to infer, to understand from what proceeds or from premises and data to derive a result. And educe, similarly, means to draw out, to extract, to elicit. So the one takes an idea and is led to another. So it's sort of like an external action, right? To deduce. But to educe means to draw something out from within your own being. Now, interestingly, the word education, or to educate, is drawn from the same root, meaning to bring up or instruct, educere. And educere, of course, is the root of educe. So educe and educate, way back, come together. So what we should be doing when we're educating someone is drawing out the secret resources of that person who is being, quote, taught. No, our action is to lead them to knowledge. They discover. Nespa. For this is the nature of law or truth in the world, that it is the just working and bringing out of that which is contained in being, implied in the essence and nature of the thing itself, latent in its self-being and self-law, swabhava and swadharma, as seen by the divine knowledge. Well, we've met these two terms before. Swabhava, literally self-being, and swadharma, which he renders as self-law. These are essential characteristics of the divine soul. To use one of those wonderful formulas of the Upanishad, which contain a world of knowledge in a few revealing words, it is the self-existent who, as the seer and thinker, becoming everywhere, has arranged in himself all things rightly from years eternal, according to the truth of that which they are. So a number of these ideas all come together in this consummating sentence. The real idea, the nature of the Supreme Soul, of the Divine Consciousness, has secretly established within his own self-existence all the world. All these becomings are within his own self, and he has arranged them according to a secret truth in them which answers to their unique nature. And their unique nature has been imparted to them by him, all of it resident within his being, all of it luminous, everything going exactly where it should go, according to the divine vision. However blinkered the mind might be, seeing things only from division and fragmentation, if we could but see the whole, and see the whole in the context of the divine awareness, then we would say, ah, got it. So here also, the conscious force, chit shakti, is that which stands behind the supermind, and that supermind stands behind the world, even manifested down to the last particle of matter. So there is an unbroken field of being. Satchit Ananda has not abrogated itself from the field. Its creative expression in the harmonic world as seen through the supramental vision, and which has extended itself forward into what seems to be a fragmentary universe dominated by mind, life, and matter. All of this is still part of that one omnipresence. There is no other place to be. Consequently, the triple world that we live in, the world of mind, life, body, is triple only in its actual accomplished evolution. Life involved in matter has emerged in the form of thinking and mentally conscious life, but with mind involved in it and therefore in life and matter is the supermind, which is the origin and ruler of the other three, and this also must emerge. We seek for an intelligence at the root of the world, and by intelligence here he means the mental reflective intelligence, and you might even read, if you're going back to the Sankhya system, the principle of buddhi as this, because intelligence is the highest principle of which we are aware, and that which seems to us to govern and explain all our own action and creation, and therefore, if there is a consciousness at all in the universe, we presume that it must be an intelligence, a mental consciousness. But intelligence only perceives, reflects, and uses within the measure of its capacity the work of a truth of being superior to itself. The power behind that works must therefore be another and superior form of consciousness proper to that truth. We have accordingly to mend our conception and affirm that not a subconscious mind or intelligence, but an involved supermind, which puts mind in front of it as the immediately active special form of its knowledge will, subconscious in force, and uses material force or will, subconscious in substance of being, as its executive nature or property, has created this material universe. So, all is enclosed in each and emerges from and at the will of this suprarational intent. And an involved supermind is driving this forward and has actually stood in creation of this material universe. That means that this divine presence is all there is. That means that our stake in the universe is something we really own, and we must discover divinity here and not flee to a heaven or ascend to a liberating moksha. It is here that we must reveal the divine. To continue, but we see that here mind is manifested in a specialization of force to which we give the name of life. What then is life, and what relation has it to supermind, to this supreme trinity of Satchit-Ananda, active in creation by means of the real idea or truth consciousness? From what principle in the trinity does it take its birth? Or by what necessity, divine or undivine, of the truth or the illusion does it come into being? Life is an evil, rings down the centuries the ancient cry, a delusion, a delirium, an insanity from which we have to flee into the repose of eternal being. Is it so? And why then is it so? Why has the eternal wantonly inflicted this evil, brought this delirium or insanity upon himself, or else upon the creatures brought into being by his terrible, all-deluding Maya? Or is it rather some divine principle that thus expresses itself, some power of the delight of eternal being that had to express and has thus thrown itself into time and space in this constant outburst of the million and million forms of life which people the countless worlds of the universe. So he has explained to this point how mind is a creative functionary of the supramental, and how wherever we detect mind, we can find with a deep penetrating vision the presence of the supramental. That mind is operating even in the materiality of the universal machinery. It's there in matter, helping to organize matter. And that implies that there is a supramental awareness which is overseeing even the mind's constructive action, doing its bidding. But now he turns to the principle of life directly. Where does it come from? From which principle of this trinity, Satchit Ananda, does it come? Satchit Ananda, and then rendering Satchit Ananda into creative play, the supramental agency. So Satchit Ananda, supermind, mind. Now where does life come from? He will eventually answer the question. This delirium, as he amusingly puts it, drawing upon life's conviction in the world of theological literature over the centuries. Or is it rather some divine principle, some power of the delight? Well, you know where he's going with this. When we study this life, as it manifests itself upon earth with matter as its basis, we observe that essentially it is a form of the one cosmic energy, a dynamic movement or current of it, positive and negative, a constant act or play of the force which builds up forms, energizes them by a continual stream of stimulation, and maintains them by an unceasing process of disintegration and renewal of their substance. This would tend to show that the natural opposition we make between death and life is an error of our mentality, one of those false oppositions, false to inner truth, though valid in surface practical experience, which, deceived by appearances, it is constantly bringing into the universal unity. Death has no reality except as a process of life. Disintegration of substance and renewal of substance, maintenance of form and change of form are the constant process of life. Life is merely a rapid disintegration subservient to life's necessity of change and variation of formal experience. So this is quite a metaphysical description beyond the physical realm of looking at what life is. This is life in the round. This is life as a pure principle. And its activity in the world is a process. It has to create, it has to destroy. Death is not a conviction into oblivion, but simply a continuation of its general process, its driving things forward. Even in the death of the body, he says, there is no cessation of life. Only the material of one form of life is broken up to serve as material for other forms of life. This draws forward the image of the Upanishads, the eater. Eating is eaten. All of the process of change is a process of nourishment. We are fed and we feed, and the process goes on. Nothing gets wasted, and he has a concluding sentence that is quite heartening. Similarly, we may be sure, in the uniform law of nature, that if there is in the bodily form a mental or psychic energy, that also is not destroyed, but only breaks out from one form to assume others, by some process of metempsychosis or new ensouling of body, all renews itself, nothing perishes. Endlessly are the elements recycled. The molecules that constitute the body, renewed, replaced, reconstituted. The life energy, withdrawn from one form, inhabits and energizes another. The mind that brought light to this particularity withdraws and places its light upon another particularity. There is no dissolution of being. In nature, all is preserved, all is reused. And so, if we can perceive that this triplicity of the world that we inhabit, mind, life, and matter, are convergent upon each other, we need no longer worry about whether we're going someplace into a darkness in which we don't exist anymore when we pass through the portals of death. Of course, the thing that really convinces you of that is when you know what you are in your soul. But even the formal elements that constitutes the soul's carriage in this world don't get thrown away. They, too, are reused. They, too, can, in a sense, be instilled with a kind of psychic immortality. To that we will come by and by. It could be affirmed as a consequence that there is one all-pervading life or dynamic energy, the material aspect being only its outermost movement, that creates all these forms of the physical universe. Life imperishable and eternal, which, even if the whole figure of the universe were quite abolished, would itself still go on existing and be capable of producing a new universe in its place, must indeed, unless it be held back in a state of rest by some higher power, or hold itself back, inevitably go on creating. In that case, life is nothing else than the force that builds and maintains and destroys forms in the world. It is life that manifests itself at the form of the earth, in the form of the earth as much as in the plant that grows upon the earth and the animals that support their existence by devouring the life force of the plant or of each other. All existence here is a universal life that takes form of matter. It might, for that purpose, hide life process and physical process before it emerges as submental sensitivity and mentalized vitality, but still it would be throughout the same creative life principle. So life creates the material world, empowers the material world, vivifies it. The term that we opened this whole chapter with is prana. Prana doesn't simply mean breath, as Sri Aurobindo has explained elsewhere. It means power. Life, the kind of life that we know upon earth, plants, animals, are a form of that prana, but do not constitute it. That is not all. Life drives the universe. Life is present in what seems to be inert matter, and it is life that stirs it into movement, life that forces it forward. Then later, life manifests as single-cell creatures, plants, animals, thinking people, moving, as he says, through these various processes, through submental sensitivity, mentalized vitality, to the full waking mind in the body. But life is there present throughout the entire universe, just as mind is present throughout the entire universe. It will be said, however, that this is not what we mean by life. We mean a particular result of universal force with which we are familiar and which manifests itself only in the animal and the plant, but not in the metal, the stone, the gas, operates in the animal cell, but not in the pure physical atom. We must, therefore, in order to be sure of our ground, examine in what precisely consists this particular result of the play of force, which we call life, and how it differs from that other result of the play of force in inanimate things, which we say is not life. We see at once that there are here on earth three realms of the play of force: the animal kingdom of the old classification, to which we belong, the vegetable, and lastly, the mere material void, as we pretend, of life. How does life in ourselves differ from the life of the plant, and the life of the plant from the not life, say, of the metal, the mineral kingdom of the old phraseology, or that new chemical kingdom which science has discovered? So this is back to the formulation of life as the common experience describes it. It is not one that Sri Aurobindo will accept, because he will see life as empowering and driving forward the entirety of the universe. And this question that he poses, we will begin to answer in our next class, because this, again, is a long chapter. And I think that we will take more than two sessions to get through it comfortably, so I think this would be a good place to break, roughly a third of the way through. So far, mind, then, is a special action of the supermind, creative and perceptive. The presence of mind implies the presence of supermind. Life is something we shall see as in a moving forward of mind, using life as a power to express itself and creatively in the universe. And we shall see where this great chain of being takes us subsequently. This idea that there is life energy present even in the physical will bring us to the historical figure of J.C. Bose in our next gathering, and you might want to look him up on Wikipedia or wherever your favorite reference tome leads you, because he was a giant of science in India and I would be happy for you to make his acquaintance. So that's where we are tonight. And I think that we can conclude again with a passage from Savitri. This is from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, and Canto 6, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. A hierophant of the bodiless secrecy, interned in an unseen spiritual sheath, the will that pushes sense beyond its scope to feel the light and joy intangible, half found its way into the ineffable's peace, half captured a sealed sweetness of desire that yearned from a bosom of mysterious bliss, half manifested in veiled reality. A soul not wrapped into its cloak of mind could glimpse the true sense of a world of forms, illumined by a vision in the thought, upbuoyed by the heart's understanding flame. It could hold in the conscious ether of the spirit the divinity of a symbol universe. This realm inspires us with our vaster hopes. Its forces have made landings on our globe. Its signs have traced their pattern in our lives. It lends a sovereign movement to our fate. Its errant waves motive our life's high surge. All that we seek for is prefigured there, in all we have not known nor ever sought, which yet one day must be born in human hearts, that the timeless may fulfill itself in things. Incarnate in the mystery of the days, eternal in an unclosed infinite, a mounting endless possibility climbs high upon a topless ladder of dream, forever in the being's conscious trance. All on that ladder mounts to an unseen end. An energy of perpetual transience makes the journey from which no return is sure, the pilgrimage of nature to the unknown. More passages to come. Namaste. Jai Maha.